Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. In this episode, we're taking a look back at some of the highlights from previous episodes. Since launching in 2019, we've made more than 400 episodes. We've explored some absolutely fascinating topics and met hundreds of wonderful people. And those people all have one thing in common, a deep knowledge of and a passion for the food and drink industry. Today, we're taking a look back at some of the best conversations that we've had about industry trends. I hope you enjoy the podcast. This edition has been made in partnership with Accenture. Now, if you're anything like me, you're probably pretty disconcerted by the amount of unpredictability and disruption that we're facing in the world today. So in this episode, we're looking ahead at how companies can react to the patterns of behaviour that we've been adopting in the face of all this disruption. After 2 years of pandemic and stresses to all the systems on which society functions, the question is, how do we identify positive ways to change, new ways of running businesses and new ways to innovate? These questions are crucially important to the future of the food industry. Well, with me are two people who've thought deeply about these issues. They're the people behind the influential Fjord Trends Report. And in this episode, we're going to look at the five key findings from their latest publication. Tatiana Penaloza is Managing Director in Consumer Goods at Accenture. Hello there, Tatiana.
Hello, Stefan.
Brilliant of you to join us. We've also got Alex Jones, who's head of Fjord London, which publishes the Fjord Trends Report and is part of Accenture Interactive. Hello there, Alex.
Hello, Stefan.
And great to have you both. Right. So, Tatiana, have you got any examples from the last couple of years where companies have reacted to change and they've done it really well because obviously the infrastructure and the world within which we're working has changed so much that they've adapted, and possibly also times when they've got it badly wrong?
Yes, absolutely. So I think Alex talks about this force habit, and what a better example to think about a new consumption space, which is the home. You know, the home became our sanctuary, became where we worked, it became where we did everything. And therefore, what we have seen as a great example is people who've responded to what is the home as the new occasion. Studies reveal that there's around a $2 trillion annual value in terms of sales that is going away from public spaces into near the home. Because if you think about it, people want to be closer to home, but also they want to support the local or the sort of neighborhood in which they live in. At the same time, similar to the fabric of life and interconnection, they want the convenience around their home, especially consumer goods. What that has driven to is many companies embarking on direct-to-consumer, for example, embarking on subscription-based models. They've embarking on, if you think about it, the number of food, beverages, companies and caterers that have opened up dark stores, dark kitchens that are all around your neighborhood. Also, the on-demand economy. So if you think about the surge of Deliveroo's, Gorillas, Uber Eats. So all these, it's like, again, and you can see the partnerships there. Sometimes it's not just one company. It's the partnerships to respond to these human examples or this human trade. And some example, Coca-Cola in Latin America, it created an app in which users were able to shop across category, but the people who replenished that order were your corner shops within 15 minutes. So again, it's that sort of home, convenience, partnership, collaboration. There's a company called Reef Technology, and what they've done is they're repurposing around 5,000 spaces, unutilized spaces. And what they're doing is opening that up as a network of microsites where people can create this hubs of service, like the dark stores or the dark distribution centers, because it believes to create this sort of cities within 15 minutes. So it's all about driving that convenience. At the same time, I think we've seen how Pret-a-Manger has evolved to create dark stores to fulfill people at home, or they've created prepackaged meals that they can sell through supermarkets. And at the same time, large companies like Nestle, for example, have acquired Mindful Chef. They've also acquired Freshly for around $1.5 billion. So you can see here is like, how are they quickly responding to this new way of buying that is at the home and it's convenient? And maybe, Stefan, to your question about who's not doing it well, I think it's just every company who's not grappled into this new way of commerce is just, you know, the goalposts moved massively with COVID. and it continues to evolve every day. And I think the companies that are not understanding what that means for them and their value proposition are the ones that are absolutely losing share or losing relevance.
And that's going to happen pretty fast, I guess, as the world changes even more rapidly.
It'll just get more complex as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that's the world that the report is looking at. But let's take a deep dive into it and find out what you discovered there. I believe you spotted five main trends. Can you briefly sketch these out for us, Alex?
Certainly. Okay, yes. So five big trends this year. First trend up here, come as you are. Okay. Now, the trend that we've spotted here is sort of alluding to that point I was making earlier, how we've all sort of put our foot on the ball, taken a moment to reflect a little on who we are, and we're emerging with this growing agency over our own lives. Now, a rise perhaps in individualism, you might say, but it's really about clarity on what matters for me. And finding confidence to turn up as myself and live my true life now. And the ripple effects are quite significant. We've heard about the Great Resignation, the impact as employees or the impact on employers trying to satisfy folks who are coming out of this lockdown, no longer really, you know, ready to endure organizations that don't give a monkey's about their daily life. So big changing dynamic for employers, but also there's this great big rise in monetizing your own hobbies. So top class sort of content creators from home, able to turn their hand to things they've always wanted to and can monetize that and make an income from it. So a big change, rise of individualism, changing the way that organizations need to engage with us as consumers, creators, and as employees. First trend, come as you are. I read somewhere the other day that when you used to say you're one in a million, it used to sound like a rare thing, you know, but now you can find 7,000 other people that are exactly the same as that one in a million thing. And you can find them online, you can share those interests, you can be proud of that. We're all sort of leaning into that a bit more, and we're expecting brands to engage in that and spot us and sort of serve us in those minutiae of market definitions now.
Mm-hmm. So, Tatiana, from a company's point of view, this is about as much about engaging with employees differently as about engaging with consumers. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think in this one, this come as you are is the sort of what we see here is almost the segment of one. No longer the stereotypical segments make sense because people do not tolerate to be sort of pigeonholed into one thing or another. So in companies as well, the sort of inclusion and diversity agenda has just broadened massively. It's no longer about the traditional pillars, but it's the intersection across those pillars. I think for consumers as well, they no longer tolerate brands that treat them as one segment or the other, because the complexity of choices that you make as an individual is really what suits you. You might remember the stat a couple of years ago that talked about something like 90-95% of plant-based food was eaten by non-vegans, right? One of Alex's peers was saying, when an anthropologist talking to people who describe themselves as, I am vegan, but I eat bacon on Sundays. And therefore, there's all these complexity of choices that people just feel unapologetically proud of what they want. So I do think it's the impact of this is that it's really challenging the way how companies are segmenting their consumers. And I think this drives to sort of an increased focus in data and analytics to really understand what do people want, in which context, and how they want it. Because ultimately, that's what will drive that relevancy of what they offer.
Today, we're looking at plant-based foods and a recent study looking at their impact on our health and the environment. Now, plant-based meat alternatives were always supposed to be better for the planet and supposed to be good for you. But as they've grown in popularity, there are claims that some of these health and environmental claims don't quite stack up. And it can be hard to cut through the noise to get to the facts, which is where Chris Bryant comes in. He's reviewed a host of previous studies to see where we're up to. Chris is research associate at the University of Bath and director at Bryant Research and has a long history of researching the field of cultivated meat. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Stefan.
That's great that you're here. Well, let's dive into a few specifics, maybe on health claims first of all. It's sometimes said that it's hard to get particular micronutrients like B12, iron, calcium, vitamin D, omega-3, unless you're eating a meat-based diet. Did you look at this? And if so, what did you find?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are, of course, plant-based sources of these vitamins and nutrients. We can get everything we need from a plant-based diet. But plant-based animal product alternatives in particular can be a good way of achieving this. So there's a couple of things to discuss here. One is that really a lot can be done with fortification of these foods. If you're buying soy milk, for example, you'll commonly find soy milk fortified with B12, that kind of thing. And this is really an area where a lot of the new research is finding new ways of fortifying plant-based food. So using fermentation, adding things like microalgae and spirulina are mentioned in some of the studies as things that you can add to actually improve that nutritional profile. So that's one thing. And then another thing, which is particular to plant-based animal product alternatives, is reducing phytic acid content. So phytic acid is naturally found in high quantities in a lot of legumes, and it actually inhibits the absorption of important vitamins and nutrients like iron, calcium, and zinc in particular. It's called an anti-nutrient in the nutrition literature. And this is one area where we actually see that processing legumes in their raw form, which are high in phytic acid, into plant-based meats, for example, can actually reduce their phytic acid content. And so it allows us to absorb those nutrients better from plant-based meats after they've been processed.
That's a fantastic twist. I like that. And I mean, I know that this is a review of reviews, but do you see the application of this knowledge being used by plant-based food producers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a huge incentive as the market develops, in particular for each brand to try to get every advantage they can in terms of making their products better for us, cheaper and tastier as well. And so a lot of the research which is done in terms of food science and improving these products is certainly going to have applications in industry.
And does the delivery mechanism matter? I mean, the way that our gut processes micronutrients from plant-based, does that work in the same way as when we process them from other sources?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, there was one study in particular which found that a diet which replaced meat with plant-based meats was actually higher in iron, but that iron was from less bioavailable sources. You know, one of the issues relating to that is phytic acid, which I mentioned. So again, that's going to be naturally found in legumes, but we can reduce the content of phytic acid by processing them into plant-based meats, and that will help us to increase absorption of iron and so on. Another study on gut health looked at comparing stool samples between groups of people who ate plant-based meat and those who were eating meat from animals. And they found that the group who ate plant-based meat had higher butyrate production and metabolization, which indicates improved gut health as well. So the authors of that study actually recommended replacing some meat consumption with plant-based meat to increase gut health.
And as the industry moves from just being able to achieve the making stuff that looks like a meat and actually achieving the production of the plant-based food, they're moving on to taste a lot more. Now, I'm wondering, is there some slack in this area? You know, can some of them be very high in salt, which is obviously we know can be linked to various health problems? And is this a pattern? Are salt levels a big problem in meat alternatives just to get that taste right?
Yeah, well, there are some studies which noted high levels of salt in plant-based products in particular. But that said, a recent review in the UK compared a bunch of meat alternative products and then a bunch of meat products and was looking in particular at the nutrients to avoid, which included salt. Now, they did classify 20% of meat alternatives as being high in salt. But when they look at the meat products, that was 46% were high in salt. So, you know, I think this is one of the many cases where we have to look at these products in the context of what they're meant to be replacing.
Yeah.
And, you know, often people will make the criticism that eating plant-based meat might not be as healthy for you as eating whole plant foods, to which the response is to say that's not what they're designed to replace, right? These are meat alternatives. They're not vegetable alternatives. Mm. So it's always important to keep in mind, you know, compared to the meat that people would otherwise be eating. And that's the key comparison we have to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you eat, as you say, you can eat an unhealthy plant-based diet as well. So if you do that, I mean, are there the same risks of heart disease apparent from a plant-based diet as a meat-based diet? Is it possible to work that out from the data that's available?
Well, it doesn't seem to be the case. We know that red meat consumption in particular is associated with increased rates of heart disease. And one of the key mechanisms for that association is that red meat is very high in trans fatty acids. So that's found in far lower quantities in plant-based meat alternatives compared to beef, for example. So this bodes pretty well for these products actually reducing the incidence of heart disease. There's one study which looked at the public health effect of integrating plant-based meats into diets in Europe, and they found that doing that would prevent over 50,000 premature deaths each year And the majority of those were coming from decreased risk of heart disease, as well as other conditions associated with meat consumption, like cancer and strokes.
That is an extraordinary figure, isn't it? Today, we're looking at mushrooms and their potential as functional foods for mind and body. Mushrooms have a long and noble history. They've been a constant feature, not just in cuisines across the world, but in medicines too. Harnessing their functional properties is nothing new either, but the mushroom is turning out to be a pretty fashionable food too. It's low in calories and carbohydrates, fat and sodium, cholesterol-free, chock full of vital nutrients and fiber, and apparently loaded with nutraceutical properties. And there's something of a boom in the mushroom world at the moment. So how is the food and supplements industry taking advantage of this boom, and how might mushrooms be used in the functional foods of the future? Well, to explore the trends, I'm joined by a mushroom-loving quartet. We have Grayson Hart, founder of supplements company Pure Sport. Hello there, Grayson.
Hey, Stefan.
Great to have you with us. Zoe Henderson is founder of Function. Hello there, Zoe.
Hi, Stefan.
Great to have you too. We've got Andy Overall, who runs the organization Fungi to Be With. Hello there, Andy.
Hi, Stefan.
And finally, we've got Simon Salter, co-founder at Dirty. Hello there, Simon.
Stefan, thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's all four of our experts with us, but we're going to start with Andy. First of all, not all mushrooms are the same. When you look at the fungi kingdom as a whole, there are 140,000 species, I remember. Some of them grow on my feet currently and in my belly button. But which mushrooms are humans particularly interested in?
The edible mushrooms obviously have a huge history, go back millennia. And those would have been trial and error, basically, sort of going out and seeing what's there and trying it, and a few people dying, and then a few people very sick, or, you know...
collateral damage.
And then another couple saying, oh, that was good. And also the medicinal properties. I mean, the Chinese have been onto that for a long, long time. Things like reishi and so forth, Ganoderma lucidum, in other words. So I think that's been the focus for a long, long, long time. But now we're getting into what the fungi are actually made of, and then products are being made out of that body, like the mycelium of the fungus, which is a tough, tough thing. And they're starting to sort of build products from that, which is a newer thing.
So the edible ones we're talking about really are sort of things like seps, pied bleu,
that's right,
girolles, and then your basic white. In particular, when we're looking at medicines, which ones crop up most frequently there?
I think the Ganoderma lucidum was like way ahead of the other bunch. But nowadays, turkey tail, which is a very common fungus on wood that grows on wood in tiers and very pretty little thing, looks like a turkey's tail, has got lots of medicinal properties, polysaccharides and so forth, that help with antioxidants and anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory properties, etc. And then you've got things like hen of the woods, Grifola frondosa, which is also seen as a good medicinal mushroom and a good edible mushroom, whereas the turkey tail is a bit tough. You might make a good tea out of it, but you wouldn't eat it.
So what about, Andy, what are the biological properties of mushrooms that make them so desirable? What's the mechanics of the thing that we want from them?
Yeah, I think flavour and texture, if you're talking about foods, of course, the texture seems to be, for me, the texture is a big thing. The flavour, sometimes the mushrooms don't really come through. You have to really push them through, you know. You have to use herbs and salt and so forth to just push them through. One of my favourites, like chicken of the woods, makes lovely chips, for instance. So I chop it up into chippy-type things and they're crunchy and so forth, and they have a very distinct flavour. And apart from that, I think all the stuff that come inside the mushroom, you know, all the minerals and the vitamins that you mentioned, and fibre for people's diets. So protein's quite high on the list for fungi. So they not only do they come with a nice texture and a nice flavour, but they also packed with vitamins and minerals.
And in terms of foraging, I mean, it does seem like, as though foraging is booming. I don't know if that's cost of living or hipsterism. But, you know, we've seen wildlife charities beginning to plead with people to stop picking mushrooms at specific places in nature reserves. But you've got some landowners who are really happy to encourage foraging and people to pick mushrooms. I mean, are you seeing a boom in interest in foraging, and why do you think that is?
It's been happening for quite a while, actually. When I first started Fungi to Be With, which was like the middle of the 90s, I was a spaceman. I was floating out in space doing fungi forays. And there was literally no one there apart from people like Roger Phillips, who'd already been out and about doing his thing. And maybe Richard Mabey, who did the Food for Three book.
He brought out a whole series of them, didn't he? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You never bumped into too many people. But then around the turn of the millennia, into the noughties, it started to pick up. And I think that was to do with European people coming over during that time. And because this is Eastern and Middle Central Europeans, because their culture includes it much more than the British culture. I mean, we were frightened of them more than anything. And they started to get involved and started to go out into the woods, and you would bump into people then. So it was about 10 years when Fungi to Be Viv was doing the walks and everything. And then we started to see more people in the woods. So since the early noughties, mid noughties, it's been gradually building up the foraging boom.
And Grayson, in terms of the market for mushroom-based products, I mean, is there any market data on it? Because there seem to be more and more products around.
Yeah, we feel there's been a huge shift in awareness towards people's real hunger to understand how to utilize, you know, some of nature's most profound healing and body and mind optimizing ingredients. And I think what we've seen is that because there's that shift in awareness and hunger for that knowledge, that the likes of publications on Netflix and some of the world's most famous sort of news platforms like the New York Times and the likes are publishing a lot of really interesting and fascinating information and articles and research about mushrooms, from the research and the scientific studies into the psychedelic mushrooms, but all the way through into your day-to-day functional mushrooms. And we feel over at Pure Sport that it's this, we call it, excuse the pun, but like a ground-up movement. We feel it's people's hunger for knowledge, the access to knowledge that maybe was harder to access. And now the shift of awareness is around how can I optimize my mind and body. And we've seen a huge spike if you look at search data on the biggest search platforms, you know, huge spikes in searches around these functional mushrooms. And I think what's amazing, we're starting to see that shift from the top down, you know, some of these mainstream medical organizations. For example, I spoke to a leading psychiatrist here in the UK who's an expert in ADHD, and he was speaking about the excitement that they have around a mushroom lion's mane for the benefits around neurogenesis, focus, memory, and helping to fight against the degeneration of cognitive function. So, what's amazing is, you know, our ancestors knew this intuitively through trial and error, and they utilized this. And now I think we're drawn to find that balance from some of the amazing scientific discoveries and knowledge through the Western medical world and big pharma and these types of things, to strike that balance back towards nature. And that's what we're really excited about, and the data is showing that.
Today we're continuing our series looking at one of the most interesting ingredients of recent times, CBD, or cannabidiol. For anyone who's somehow missed the rising success of CBD, it's an extract of hemp or cannabis, which has found a welcome home here in the UK's food and drink sector. In a previous episode, we looked at its neurological effects and its use in pain control, and we looked at the distinction between its use as a medicine. Today is all about the food and drink sector. If you want to dip your toe in, join the CBD ice cream makers, energy bar producers, and so on, where should you start? Working out which products might succeed and marketing to interested customers is quite a challenge. So to explore the trends and consumer understanding of this new sector, I'm joined by Lauren Lovett, founder of Plant Academy. Hello there, Lauren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. And we've got Dave Gibson, founder of Gibson's Goodology. Hello there, Dave.
Good morning. How are you?
Really good. And thank you so much for joining us. The UK has become a pretty good market for CBD, hasn't it? Why do you think that is? What is it about the UK market and UK consumers that's enabled this to happen?
Yeah. I mean, first off, it's CBD, not THC. THC is the psychoactive part of the plant, and CBD is the wellness. Think Gwyneth Paltrow for CBD and think, I don't know. Canada had a real point to prove, and they had to regulate the heck out of the market to really set the precedent and set the benchmark for this new plant that's been illegal because of the United States since 1920s. around there. But the UK went a different route. The UK allowed CBD, as it is a wellness product, to go through all the entree, all the restaurants, all the bars, all the stores. So we had a lot more retailers being open to buying it and giving it to the consumers. So the accessibility is really good for the consumers in the UK, but we haven't even scratched the surface. We're in Selfridges. I do sampling myself in Selfridges because being close to the customer is so important for us. And there's still a huge amount of a lack of knowledge around CBD. And a large reason is because we're still not allowed to market or communicate about it freely on Facebook or Google that owns 70% of the internet, because it's not federalized in the United States, and Google and Facebook are American companies.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you're able to buy it in the UK, but still it's not getting as good of traction as we were hoping for.
That's really interesting. So the opportunity is big, but the channels to communicate that are complex. Now, Lauren, this is one of the fastest growing wellbeing product categories in the UK. It's worth more than the vitamin C and D market combined, expected to be worth £1 billion by 2025. From your point of view, when you're looking at this as an ingredient used in lots of different things, where do you see the exciting areas? Where is the demand from consumers focused?
The thing that I've seen, obviously, like, you know, whether it's at a supper club or I'm teaching or anything, there's so much kind of, oh yeah, I know what CBD is. Like, they know kind of what it is, but there's this kind of, yeah, people are still very unaware of exactly some, often the benefits, the like exact benefits, and also how to really use it apart from just taking it under your tongue. And I think, you know, we're seeing more and more like cocktail bars using it as a primary ingredient, and also restaurants. There was a place down in Brighton called the Canna Kitchen at one point, which it was a, such a, you know, major thing in what's their whole concept, really. Yeah. Using CBD. So people are wanting, I think, to use it more in edible things. I mean, whether that's kind of chocolate bars, products, I mean, there are a lot out there. But exactly as Dave was saying, I think there's this thing of like, oh yeah, I want to try that, but there's not the awareness specifically why and then how to actually use it for themselves. And the primary thing that I noticed teaching classes, especially at places like, I also teach at Leith's, which has a really traditional curriculum compared to what we teach, which is a bit more, you know, future forward and trend predicting with Plant Academy. Yeah, people are a little bit frightened to actually use it confidently and not to give people like an overdose of CBD. They're like, oh, how much would I use? So I think the thing I'm really noticing is seeing it in products is with a little bit of sort of education on the packaging, like something that people can actually grasp onto and understand.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is also seeing it more and more in cosmetics. So there's a brand that I work with, Good Hemp, and they've just bought out a CBD balm, and they're a very interesting brand because they do make hemp products very accessible, and they're very, very good at communicating, you know, like why we use hemp and also CBD and all of those things. So I think the education piece is a huge one.
And, you know, people just on that too, people really love it when they start to try it. Like one of the things that keep us going every day are the letters and the emails from people saying it's helped with our knee, it's helped with our sleep, it's helped with our anxiety, it's helped with our headaches, it's helped. I mean, that's what keeps us going. The UK government recommends 70 milligrams a day. Right now, products that we're seeing like chocolate bars are lower than that. So we still have a way to go for the public to use more of it at 70 milligrams a day. And that $1 billion worth of growth statistic that you mentioned is out of date. I know the guys that put those numbers together, and that was done a year to 2 years. And there were two specific reports associated to that 2025 forecast. And things didn't happen the way they should have. The Food Standards Authority and EU still have not approved the CBD products. The 200 different licenses were one of them that are with the European FSA. They're super late for getting this approved. And that means big retailers aren't accepting our products into their stores like Whole Foods, Dalesford. So that's one thing. The FSA is slow, very slow. Google and Facebook should have federalized. That's not going to happen this term. So that 2025 $1 billion of growth is an outdated number.
Mm. That's really interesting. Yeah, we discuss a lot about the how slow the FSA is to approve and the complexities of leaving the EU and novel foods issues. And that's in our previous episodes. If you haven't heard that, take a little listen to that. We discussed the legislation about that. Yeah. Now, what I'm interested in, to put that aside for a second, is the use of CBD in alcohol and non-alcoholic spirits, which I think has become, as Lauren mentioned, a big boom area. Now, this, in a sense, Dave, do you think that this is a sort of a statement of intent or a statement of romance, in a way, for a brand? Are people just invoking the concept of CBD as a way of saying, we're a bit different, we're a bit new, we're a bit naughty, possibly, we're trying something? It implies a whole world of different inferences, doesn't it?
It really does. The alcohol versus no alcohol and mixing with cannabis is a big one. It's a huge one. Look, alcohol and the wellness product of CBD do not go together. It's complete antithesis of each other, right? So this trend, this novel trend that popped up with mixing CBD with alcohol was probably a legacy from mixing THC with alcohol, right? But the wellness product and alcohol are complete polar opposites of each other and really have no reason to be mixed. The NOLO, the no alcohol evolution of CBD is big. And that's really where we're talking a proper a sober sommelier, no alcohol drink with CBD as a replacement for non-drinkers is reality. And we're seeing it more and more on restaurant menus in the UK under the non-alcoholic drinks. And people are really liking it right now in restaurants and bars. So yeah, I think this CBD delicious way to consume a CBD wellness supplement is here to stay.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.